Hey, this is Diva Stevan on Loops. I'm an artist from Bristol and I'm interested in making works that can represent various Nepali-British experiences. On this podcast, I would like to introduce you to a prominent figure, our big sister Premila Tamang, currently a PhD student specializing in how children of Gorkhas in UK are exploring their heritage and practicing cultural expressions. She's also the director of the campaign group Gorkha Equal Rights. All her involvements have been a terrific support for our elders and a massive inspiration to the younger Nepali generations. Hope you are ready to follow our voice, taking you back to early as 1800s to uncover over 200 years of history and understand the ongoing relation between Nepal and Britain. Thank you for tuning in. You are now listening to Loops Podcast, brought to us by Caribou Projects. Let's go.
Okay, so I am now reading Nothing Personal by James Baldwin and a section of the writing that he's written. So it says, "It is no accident that ancient Scottish ballads and Elizabethan chants are still heard in those dark hills. Talk about a people being locked in the past. To be locked in the past means, in effect, that no one has no past, since one can never access it or use it. And if one cannot use the past, one cannot function in the present. And so one can never be free." That's really interesting about, basically he's saying that, you know, when he talks about ancient Scottish ballads or the value of these old stories, talking about the value of how we need that, you know, of history, of historical understanding. Because if we don't know where we're from, it's very difficult. It says, right, like if one cannot, if you don't know the past, you can't really function in the present. And that, there's always the quote, "History repeats itself." So I think it's very much about that, about how it is relevant to think about the Gurkhas. I would say on few levels. I mean, there is the Gurkha history that's relevant for the British public and understanding, yes, this 200 years of loyalty and friendship that the Gurkhas have had with Britain, with the crown, in a sense, right? In how Gurkhas fought for Britain in so many wars, not just the Great World Wars, but even back in the 1800s and Afghan wars, or fought even in India, and then later post-World War One and Two worked to fight in Malaysia and Brunei, and also protected British interests in Hong Kong for so many years. Without the Gurkhas, Britain wouldn't be where it is right now. And then the Gurkhas themselves and Nepalese themselves also have to remember history on the Nepali side. Why did Nepal sell its sons or send its sons? Which, it sounds like, okay, so why did Nepal send its sons away? And what was the context in which so many people would go and fight in strange lands, you know, for a queen they never met or knew about? There was no telly back in the day. You know, what was the conditions, the historical social conditions that compelled young men to leave? So there's a lot of layers of history that also needs to be recognized there. But it's actually a special diplomatic treaty, right? It's actually a special condition in which Nepal is allowing a foreign country to recruit soldiers on its land. Nepal benefits from that as well. So that history also needs to, for Nepali people to understand that in the way that ethnic minorities have been treated. And series of governments stand to benefit so much as a poor country from the money that the UK government pays annually, which doesn't always filter to the rest of the people. So, you know, there's these histories, which is, I would say, of two different nations, but certainly those two nations will need to understand, you know, where the Gurkhas were, how relevant they were in their own country's histories. And then there's also the layer of family history itself, how older pensioners, veterans, widows should share their experiences and pain, stories and traumas to the younger generation so they understand that they don't, they know not to be placed in situations where their rights, where they're not treated equally, you know, or where their rights can be taken away so easily. So, you know, I would say that's kind of like a threefold element that strikes me from this quote in the importance of history and stories. But a lot of young people had no clue what was going on, including, even though I'm a little older, including myself. And for me, it was what inspired me, first of all, just seeing very old pensioners walk the streets and protest. I'd never seen pensioners protest in my life like that. I do know that happens in the UK, but, you know, to see from your own community be doing that, and then all these soldiers, you know, ex-soldiers who are your grandfather's age, just standing in the rain in really horrid conditions, not eating anything. 24-hour hunger strike relay was warning to the government to say, listen, if you don't do this within 13 days, we are going to be serious and we're going to fast on to death. But even within the 24 hours, when somebody is, you know, in their 60s and 70s, standing out there and the weather is so horrible, you get very concerned for their health, seeing how they were treated in the rain. The police took away the chairs of the old veterans. I mean, one of them is 75. People made to sit in the wet floor all night. The veterans were not allowed to sleep. It was against the rules, so police would come and check in to see. They were arbitrary. One of the nights when it was just women, then they left the women alone. They let the women sit on chairs, and they let the women have umbrellas, but they didn't let the women sleep either. Miss Pushpara Nagale, widow of a veteran, she was going to fly in from Nepal, and it was her first time in the UK as well. So she was flying in from Nepal, and then she was under the obligatory quarantine rules. Poor woman, she was in England for the first time, and then by the, you know, after the quarantine in the hotel and being able, I think she was only able to go out for 2 days. Not even see much. And then she went straight onto the hunger strike. And understanding that people were so dedicated that they would be even flying in from a different country, you know, to put their lives on the line, that was really something. One of the things that really caught my eye in the very beginning, on the first day of the hunger strike relay, when I sat and got to talk to the veterans, introduced myself. I said, hey, I'm a PhD student. I want to find out about young Gurkhas, but obviously I see you also have had a lot of issues and I would like to learn from you. And he told me, when I was in service, we learned how evil the Japanese were. You know, we learned from our forefathers who fought in the world wars that, you know, it was a just war because we had to fight against Japan because Japan was taking over the world. What we didn't realize was, as we started working for the British were doing the same things to the world that they were saying the Japanese were doing. So it really made me think about colonialism and imperialism. I found that consciousness of empire quite interesting that the veterans were quite aware about it. You know, the kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. What I found interesting with the older generation and how they had so much to say was I was curious why they didn't say it to their children. It feels that there was this disconnect between the older generation. And part of that, I think, is, you know, perhaps aspects of Asian, Nepali culture where you want, as a parent, you always want to be protective. And so you don't want to share sad stories or trauma to your children, you know, so you act really strict. But actually, there's a lot of trauma underneath. And a lot of the veterans here and a lot of the elderly pensioners in the UK who are from, you know, Gurkha backgrounds, either as Gurkha veterans or their widows or couples, they don't really have much immediate family in the UK. They came after the settlement rights were achieved, but they were not allowed to bring their children because their children were already old. And there was even a fight for a long time for families to be allowed to bring children who were over 18. So because of that, a lot of the largest bulk of suffering is from these pensioners who retired before 1997. Then you have perhaps maybe your father's generation or, you know, many who were able to come here and bring their children as teenagers, finished after 1997. So in a sense, they got half equal rights because the ruling from the Ministry of Defense regards Gurkha pensions is that there's a pension scheme called the Armed Forces Pension Scheme, which is for those who retire after 1997. Those before that were given the Gurkha pension scheme. And then those who, you know, if they were half and half in between, then they were able to move to the other Armed Forces pension scheme. So I think because most of, say, the parental generation here, they still have a huge loss of pensions, but not to the degree as the elders. And also they have wider networks. So their children are established in jobs, even after their service, whether it's as a security guard, you know, most of work like that. They don't complain as much, perhaps, you know. Part of it is just exactly to say, listen, we're here now, let's get on with the job and let's not try to fight for everything and rock the boat. We have to be good citizens, especially when most of the Nepalis here haven't been here for many generations. Most Nepalis only started settling in the UK after 2004. And so as a very new migrant community, where it seems that the public have given you this goodwill to be able to settle in the country, the last thing you want to do is be shouting on the streets and saying it's not enough. But it is quite interesting just how words like imperialism, colonization, racial discrimination, they get used about even amongst older people. I'd never heard that before, you know, and I think that is also the influence of Black Lives Matter, where people then become a little bit less scared to point out racism. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. Because, you know, Gurkhas have that really interesting space as an ethnic minority in the UK. You know, as Gurkhas, it's almost a different type of model minority and often very xenophobic and negative stereotypes for different types of people of color. But for Gurkhas, it's suddenly like, oh, you're a Gurkha. Yeah, there's all this fantasy and romance and idealism about what the Gurkha is, almost sometimes as saviors of many British men, saviors of empire, saviors of different soldiers and wars, you know. And Gurkhas have this very special place within UK military history. But one of the things that the Gurkhas are fighting for is the children's rights. and dual citizenship, because they are aware that if you are going to, they think, okay, it's great, you know, the British public love us, the Queen loves us, right? But how long is that going to last? One day something might happen where we're going to get kicked out. And if we're going to get kicked out, or maybe we might not get kicked out, but our children, maybe they do something wrong or whatever, they get kicked out, where are they going to go? Where are they going to call home? There's a lot of veterans who were made redundant far below the 15-year threshold in order to qualify for pensions. As low as the pensions was, there's many that don't even have any pensions. And when I talked to them, they said, you know what, we might never get it because we were made redundant, but we're still here to fight to be able to ensure a better future for our children. The problem with the protests is that in British media, especially, you know, last year, it's all framed as a pension issue, but it's not about just pensions. It's about racism. It's about equality. It's about the kind of different inequalities that they experience. Just something simple, such as not being able to see your family for 3 years. So Gurkhas could only see their family once every 3 years. And that's on unpaid leave as well. You know, maybe they get to see their dad once every few years only. And because everyone that you go to school around with or the community that you grow up with have a lot of people like that, it just so normalized. One man I spoke to, the 75-year-old gentleman who was shivering in the rain, he quit the army because he wasn't allowed to go back home for his dad's funeral. So in the end, he thought that that was more important. Pensions, right? That's very easy to quantify in numbers. And you can say, okay, fine, pre-1997, you know, this is how much a British officer within a rank gained per annum for pension. And it was almost always almost 1,000% less with Gurkha equivalent, you know. So how do you work out the maths or the time lost of family time? How do you work out the maths of somebody's psychology, the sort of trauma that they build, the even, you know, the everyday right to family life that other soldiers were awarded? Now, if this was the case for all British Army soldiers, or let's say just overseas soldiers from the Commonwealth, then, you know, you could argue that this and that's that just comes with a job, and that's just the way it is. But when it's just the Gurkhas that are singled out that way, in the terms of disruption of family dynamics, you know, and it is also something that I hear about how men will gather together and how they cry, how they get drunk and they will cry about not having seen their kid born or not, you know, being able to miss out on their children's lives, but they will never say that to your face. Other women in the hunger strike, Shaindra Didi, she's, I think she was 19 when she was widowed. She had her child very early, but also was widowed very early. And so you have those who suffered, people, you know, people who suffered from not even seeing their children grow up. But then you also have widows, you know, where like they never even had that chance as well. And then to find out that they only get 60% of pensions. You know, when you're from a very, very poor society, then you think, well, even if it's so tiny, it's better than nothing. Yeah. So that's, yeah, the story of women is an even more silenced history. Yeah. And that's, yeah, so it was important to have a woman in the hunger strike as well to say, hey, you know, this is not just about pensions, not just about men. Nepal has over 100 different languages, ethnicities, and castes. And those aren't dialects. They will have sub-dialects underneath them as well. And, you know, at the time of the World Wars, actually, Nepalis of all races, ethnic backgrounds, formed the Gurkha army. It wasn't majority Magar, Gurung, Limbu, or Rai, these typical tribes that are now known, you know, to have a lot of Gurkha recruits. Britain's always played with the idea of regional of recruiting soldiers from particular regions as a way to rule or subjugate other areas. So the Sikhs, for example, are also considered a martial race. And then the Maasai in Kenya are also considered warriors under like British colonial constructs. So this idea of certain tribes or races becoming naturally born warriors has been used quite a bit throughout British history. But moving back to the point of the Nepali caste system, the Nepali caste system is a modified Hindu caste system. What happened was, you know, a little over 200 years ago, around the same time as well, when, you know, Nepal then decided to have treaties with Britain, is, you know, when Nepal was becoming unified, these were done by conquest of rulers from West Nepal, right? And these were Hindu rulers. They decided one way to rule Nepal was it would be easier to have a one religion, one nation, one language policy. It was a dynasty that was ruling Nepal, right? With Prithvi Narayan Shah considered the founding father of Nepal. And then this dynastic monarchy was then overthrown by a new dynasty called the Ranas. And in effect, it was this kind of family of prime ministers, one after the other, either the brother or the cousin or the son or something, you know, that took turns in ruling Nepal. And so they then solidified even more what the caste system was going to be. So then they created a law called the Muliki Ain, and it was a codified law of different rules for the castes. And within that, they divided the castes into, you know, you had the Brahmins at the very top, you had the Chhetris, in India it'll be called the Kshatriyas, you know, it's the warrior class. But then where to put all these different tribes or ethnic groups that were originally not Hindu, how do you fit them in? You know, are they an untouchable? What are they, right? And so this became the bulk of the Gurkha recruits as well. So these different castes, they decided to call them the Matwali. Now, do you know what Matwali? Matwali means alcohol drinker, or basically alcoholics. Because, you know, like a pure Brahmin would not touch alcohol, right? So we were the alcohol drinkers or the Matwalis. And then this was also divided into two. So you had the non-enslavable alcoholics, and then you had the enslavable alcoholics. And this was, who knows, a possibly divide and rule tactic, because the ethnic groups that surrounded the capital of Kathmandu, the original, you know, ethnic groups that inhabited before the Rana and Shah rulers came over, the Newars, the Tamangs, there are different groups around there. They, they were not allowed to join the Gurkha forces. And yeah, maybe it's because if they got skills, they'd take over the valley, who knows? And so then recruitment centers were on either side instead. So it was, you know, in the far east of Nepal, where the Rai and Limbus, the Kirat peoples were, and then in the far, and then in the west, where the Gurungs and Magars were. And post-World War, what happened is it's possible that the idea of the martial race also became actually solidified post-World War. Pre-World Wars, Chhetris, anybody joined, you know, almost one in five men or so, something like this. You know, I will have to check the of Nepalis went to fight in the different world wars. And so many of them went missing as well, you know, killed, wounded, missing. You know, that army was made up of everybody, whether they were Chetri or maybe poorer Brahmins, who knows, you know, it was all mixed. And then I was reading this old ethnographies and research into Gurkha communities, and especially past the World Wars, those older veterans, their generation, the parents did not want their, because they'd seen the suffering, experienced the horrors of war, they did not want their sons and their children to join at all. And so Britain had to come up with different types of strategies. There's stories of recruiters or strangers coming to Gurung villages, for example, and mothers hiding away their children or telling their kids to go, you know, hide in the jungle before they can get captured to be made as soldiers. It's a very different attitude from now, where being a Gurkha soldier is like the best and thousands of people compete for it, right? It's a total 180 attitude. And part of the recruitment, then what happened was the British thought it's much easier just to recruit. This isn't written in stone. This is what's implied, right? You know, it's much easier to recruit people from certain areas when you have family networks. So this is why whole villages in East and West Nepal that come from particular tribes, it's almost like somebody's a Gurkha one way or another, you know? And being a soldier is a way to get out of that poverty. So what happened with these people is not only were people considered classified as alcoholic races almost, you know, it was so entrenched. You had very sexist laws. So in law, if you were, say, an upper caste Brahmin, Hindu Brahmin man, and you were found to have a relationship with an untouchable or Matwal, you know, somebody outside your caste, then you could be demoted. So, you know, from being a Brahmin, you could become a Chetri. So like your caste status is, your caste status is demoted, and maybe you get like, I don't know, 90 lashes publicly, both man and woman. But if you're a lower caste man, like a Matwali or a Dalit, an untouchable, and you were found having a relationship with a high caste woman, Brahma woman, then you'd get the death penalty. So you'd have these very, very strong anti-intermarriage laws. You know, we think about South Africa and apartheid. There were very, very strict laws against intercaste marriage in the old days. And so that keeps tribes within themselves. But, you know, it just goes to show how entrenched the caste system was itself in how people were able to access services, get education, and so on and so forth. And this is still, you know, a problem in Nepal to this day. There have been huge improvements, but, you know, there's still so many big remnants of the caste system in the ways that there's very little representation of different ethnic minorities in certain seats of power in the government. So what happened with this the idea of the martial race? So basically, the British considered certain races as naturally gifted warriors, but they didn't think of Nepalis as naturally gifted warriors from day one, even though there was this 200 relationship. It kind of became stronger and stronger over time. And then after the World Wars, when, you know, Nepalis had won Victoria Crosses, this just raised up the level of how Nepalis were conceptualized. And then post-World War, then the British were saying that, okay, some of these Nepalis are belong are martial races, and so they consider that the four groups, you know, two in the west, which is the Malgar and Gurung, and two in the east, which is the Rai and Limbu. And they said, okay, these are the martial races, you know, they're the fiercest people in all of Nepal, which might sound like a great stereotype, but what happens is that just creates whole communities of generational recruitment into the army. And on one hand, it's helped raise some of these communities, you know, into better social economic levels with the money and the experiences that Gurkhas were able to bring from abroad. But on the other hand, it's almost draining young men all the time, right? There's always somebody ready to be recruited, and there's always an uncle who can teach you how to get you into an army or train you and, you know, make you run every morning so that you're well built or whatnot. So it becomes very difficult, and especially once the Gurkhas have retired and they go back to the village, there isn't much of a life there, right? Or, you know, they've realized that, no, actually, they would like their kids to go to a good school. And all the things that, that goes back to the pensions, you know, that the pensions are formulated because it's considered fair, is kind of thinking of farmers' level, a subsistence farmer level of pay. And that's not enough for a farmer to, upon retirement with a Gurkha pension, to send their kids to good schools. So what happens is they realize, listen, there isn't enough money. So they're going to go out again, and they're going to go abroad again and work as manual laborers in different countries. Leaving just, yeah, it becomes very difficult for the communities just to have so many absent young, strong men. The conditions obviously have been so much better than the world wars. And because people are able to bring consumer goods from back into very poor villages, it becomes glamorous and a bit of an adventure for young men to aspire to. You know, it's a way to get out, as you said, a way to get out of poverty. I mean, these the villages and the ethnic, you know, the ethnic communities and their localities from which the many of the Gurkhas come from, you know, because they've been historically marginalized as these alcoholic castes in the first place, this is why they were poor. If they came from very well-off families or, you know, had very good levels of decent standards of living, nobody would feel compelled to go out into the world and become a soldier, you know. I know that's putting it in very simplistic terms at the moment, and there's exceptions to everything, but it makes you think about the martial race. And the martial race was also one way to pivot the English. Like, part of it is kind of there's different literature on it. There's a very good one by an anthropologist named Lionel Kaplan, and it's called Warrior Gentlemen, the Gurkhas in Western Imagination. Or something, yeah. I hope that's the exact title. The martial race itself as a concept was an imperial construct, which was not just for Nepalese, but was also used with different ethnic groups that the British, you know, in areas that the British were looking to rule. There's also different feminist scholars who have written about the notion of the martial race and with Gurkhas, and how they look at it from a feminist perspective, where they look at it as a way to sort of emasculate the populations that the British were subjecting. So, for example, Nepalese have the stereotype as the martial race. So they would write about how, you know, Nepalese or Gurkhas are so manly. They drink, you know, on one hand, being an alcoholic, you know, drinking, being a matwali is not great in Nepal's society. under the what, you know, the ruling classes view as appropriate or cultured people. But on the other hand, for the British, it was like, hey, yo, here's these guys that we can have a pint with. These are guys that also have a good laugh. They're manly. They're fierce. They're not like these Indians who don't drink so much alcohol. They're not like these, you know, prissy, feminine Indians. You know, the way, I mean, I'm not saying that's what they are, but that's the kind of material that they wrote. And it's one way to really, like, use one group to you know, subjugate another for for empire, right? You know, and it's a way to dehumanize Indians. It's a way to dehumanize the rest of the people as well, to say that they were not real men or not manly enough. In the British Army, the superiority of one regiment over another is mainly a matter of training. The same courage and military instinct are inherent in English, Scotch, and Irish alike. But no comparison can be made between the martial value of a regiment recruited amongst the Gurkhas of Nepal or the warlike races of northern India, and of one recruited from the effeminate peoples of the south. You know, martial races is also quite a divide-and-rule tactic, if you put it in the simplest terms, because as you mentioned, you know, Nepalis who have been recruited, all these communities, you know, the ethnic groups who have been recruited as warriors, as soldiers, do not have a military background of war. You know, aside from those who are recruited, it's not as if Tamangs or Rais or Limbus were, you know, always at war for centuries and always being warriors. No, most of them were subsistent farmers. Yeah. And it's about where can you find a cheap deal, as one veteran said, Siam Thakuri is a wonderful veteran that I met. And he said, we were the cheapest of the cheap. Yeah. And in terms of diplomatic history, not the martial races, but the Ranas were also very good at understanding that the British needed Nepali recruits. So especially in the world wars, they would be, there are all these old historical documents and code of language, really where the Ranas were bargaining with Britain on, you know, getting more money out of being able to send Nepalis. And Nepalis themselves, who were becoming who became soldiers, didn't really get much money at all. But the Rana government certainly did. And they kind of bargained Nepali bodies that way. So that's why this scholar Mary Duchenne calls Gurkhas as diplomatic currency. And they felt that they created regiments that were purely based on the caste, the British. So, you know, if you were in the 7th Gurkha Rifles, for example, I think they were mainly Rai. And then you'd have a different Gurkha rifle, and that's mainly all Gurung. They thought that by recruiting people from the same areas, right, you have already these ties, these cultural understandings, language, shared tribal languages. It makes it easier to command a unit that way. So that's what was done. You know, it could have easily been some other group. It wasn't some inherent quality. But that's not to say that one shouldn't have pride in the sort of legacy that was created afterwards. You know, it's in a sense, maybe one was made a martial race, right? Not that one was a martial race to start with. And it also is very easy for the Nepal government, being Hindurana rulers. I mean, who are you going to sell off easily, right? You're going to sell off the people that are ethnic minorities that are quite expendable in a sense, you know. They didn't allow lots of, you know, different Hindu groups, for example, to become Gurkhas. Yeah, it was the non-Hindu groups then, maybe to be made into Hindu assimilation as, or easily expendable, or both, you know, could I'm sure there's a lot of different factors at play, but none that really, by any, you know, whatever the reasons were, and there are many, it all still points to how very marginalized ethnic minorities were exploited. Most of these men left as teenagers. So, you know, the years of their life where they themselves, if they were living in the village, could have learned about a lot of different cultures and rituals, or, you know, been able to continue to speak their tribal language, they also weren't afforded that luxury, in a sense, right? For them, what they saw as a luxury. So, yeah, even for... well, one of these uncles said, you know, Gurkhas were neither here or there. I'm not fully Nepali. I'm not really English either. I don't know where I am, because I've just, since I was so young, I have to go around the world and go to different places. I didn't really have time to develop my cultures. And that history is, yeah, important, even in the way we sort of move forward in our culture. The exploitation of Nepal's ethnic minorities due to this caste system as well is explains a lot of other aspects of Nepali history as well. You know, when the Ranas were ruling, for example, ethnic minorities, people were not even allowed to go to school. And you could be jailed for reading a book. You know, it's a great way to keep people, right? If people are not educated, then it's a great way to keep them down. And it explains why, even for Nepali language, a lot of writing and intellectual literature and things like that, it bloomed in India, where people went in exile instead. And in one way or another, anybody with any Nepali roots, that Gurkha history is part of our identity in some degree. So Gurkhas have been such a major part of different formations of world history. I have already seen the fetishization of Nepaliness and Nepali history here with the diaspora. This is always the case with, we always want to know the best about ourselves, right? There's a very sad saying by one of the veterans who said, Gurkha's blood is shed all over the world. And so, it's important that when you have that pride, to also honor that history, to not just have that just as rhetoric, right? And then how to be able to hold that on. So that ethnic heritage and stories and remembering is a joint process. It's not just the younger generation in a diaspora that finds it difficult to understand their parents' culture, but you have to, they have to understand that their parents' cultures themselves were quite repressed or oppressed, yeah. And so their parents themselves are in this mode of what anthropologists would call like ethnic revivalism. So you are asking a question on cultural transmission, right? And like the transmission of traditions, for example, and heritage and stories. And that's a struggle for every generation. I think there are several ways. Understanding military history, we can read it in books, and certainly that is really, really important. There is so much literature online that is starting to develop, and books that we can get. It is slowly being written about. It is quite new. You know, there are a lot of old books on Gurkhas written by British military officers that will only just speak in terms of stereotypes. But the critical pieces on Gurkhas is very few, but it's growing and it can easily be found online as well. And then the other aspect, though, is actually to speak to veterans, to speak to different family members, ask them your experiences. There's a living history, you know, and sometimes that can even be richer than any of the books that you're going to read. Then you understand the price. And then when you understand the sacrifices that have been made, and then the price that even your fathers, your forefathers, their wives, widows, grandmothers, everybody has had to pay, that will help you understand your situation more and how to be able to make difference in the future. You know, how to stand up for other people's rights, how to stand up for your own rights, how to understand that, you know, you are where you are because of particular conditions in history. Well, how are we going to be treated when we're old pensioners, right? Are we also going to be neglected and discarded even though we think everything's fine right now? So these are the important lessons on how to be able to learn from history to try and fight for what we can now in order to ensure a better future. I mean, this is what every Gurkha soldier has always done.
A big thank you to Premila Didi for guiding us through such deep history and giving us clarity on present situations. Gratitude to our elders. You have been the main source of inspiration. We owe it all to you. Lastly, a massive thank you to Caribou Projects for the opportunity and support. It means a lot to have our voices heard.
This episode was made possible thanks to funding from Arts Council England.